Now, me and my friend Steph, we he used to live next door, as I said before. He did accountancy or studied at the London School of Economics, and he's now a really close friend living locally as well here. And we have trips. We go back to Leighton, go back to Northcote.
You
Yes,
don't.
we do. Yeah. We go back every so often and have a drink there, and
You go on this secret nostalgia
yeah,
trip.
we are, especially when the other guys come over as well from wherever they're living in Denmark or wherever they're bankers. They're all bankers now, big bankers. When we all meet up, we tend to go to Leighton and get really drunk in the Northcote. I remember the days. Yeah.
That's really funny.
It's just like a nostalgic trip every so often. Yeah. That's one thing. I wonder what I actually as I said before, I wonder what's happened to Tommy and all the other kids in the street. I hope they're all okay. I mean, I hear from the Tommy's in the city working. That's really good. I mean, and the other boys. Yeah.
That was the little boy.
The little boy, yeah, Tommy, he was 9 years old when I last saw him. I think 9 or 11. Yeah. Lots of people suspected he did a lot of the burglary actually for fun, but I don't think it was Tommy.
No.
Yeah.
And also, when he was there in 94, did any of the evictions start happening in Colville Road, or was that after you left?
I think the road is evicted part by part, isn't it? And still some of it's still left there, isn't it? Some of Colville Road.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. I think we were amongst the first to go, because actually our house got burnt. People next door to me got moved out before I did for some reason. Yeah, number 64 got moved out before 66, and they moved off. And I remember coming home from the studio one evening, and it was a blaze. And next door, and the fire people had come. They'd put the fire out, and I went back in the night because I could still see smell smoke. And I went back to the house to check. Like at midnight, and look, I could see the flames literally about to kick off again, and I called the fire brigade back, and they accused me of trying to burn the house down. Yeah, because I remember thinking how dry the wood was in my house from all the dry rot, and I know how that works with the fire. And I remember thinking I didn't want to feel safe, I didn't want to sleep next door to it because I felt it was a bit worrying, like it's like cork when dry rot dries that wood. I remember thinking, I'm just going to go and check to make sure I don't fall asleep and get killed in this house. So I went back into the house next door before I went to bed to check it, see if it's all the fire. And it was still just honestly, literally at that point, it's about to kick off again. So I called the fire brigade and they came and they accused me of trying to start a fire in the house. They didn't pursue it. They just said it. A few of them said it, and I said no, I didn't. I just came to check, and luckily I did because I could have been, right next door, badly.
Because that was another thing that was reported in the newspaper, was down Colville Road there was not only a spate of burglaries, but a spate of fires.
Yeah, I reckon it's Tommy and those kids. What do you do? I mean, I remember when I lived in Leeds years back, I lived in an area which was going to be redeveloped, and the same thing happened. I remember as an 11-year-old, I used to go rummaging through the houses to find things to break, to burn, and to, like with all the gangs of boys, and I reckon that's probably what was happening at the time there, because when things are out of your hands, you find ways of empowering yourself, even as a child. So you go and destroy, you break things. I've broken so many old LPs, in those days back in Leeds when I was a kid, just people left behind. I can break all the old furniture and break the windows and stuff. Yeah, I reckon that must have happened as well. That was happening in Colville Road. That made it easy to move out, really, at the time. Put the pressure on, doesn't it? Put the pressure on people living there to move out. Yeah.
Any other things that you can think of?
Stories of Leighton, gosh, people I lived with are quite interesting. I lived with a interesting German lady who wrote a thesis on androgyny in the house. It's quite nice. I felt quite a nice time to be there, can't remember her name now, really, but she lived there for a little while. And she used to have her German friends come over and have their lesbian affairs and stuff, and it was fantastic. It's really intriguing for the boys next door to know that there was like three lesbian living in one room up, you know, in my house. And they used to sneak into to look at their look at them in the bathroom and stuff. Oh, no. Yeah, but that's a bit daft, really, just boys. Anything else? Yeah, I did feel bad about not paying owing money to to Acme, because they, you know, they provide a good service for us, really. You know, having somewhere cheap to live at the time, which is what I needed. I felt I wanted anyway. Wrongly or rightly, because I reckon if I left art school thinking I was going to be the richest person in the world, I probably would have made different choices and probably made more money in the process. But I did leave art school thinking I wanted to live as cheaply as possible and work as hard as possible, make as many paintings as possible. I didn't think about the money, you know, I just wanted to make good pictures and make a, you know, good go of it, really. Yeah, and I taught at various colleges at the time as well, so that, I mean, that's, you know, supported income.
Yeah, where did you teach?
At the time I taught at, my first job was, when I was living in Camberwell, was working in college in Brixton. Then I started teaching at Morley College. Then I taught at Chelsea and the Slade for a while, and Westminster College. Then I went to America and left all my jobs behind. I did, I just left it all behind. Just, I think it's partly to do with the stress of being in Colville Road at the time. Just the powerlessness. Not even the fact that I knew, as I said before, I knew I was going to leave at some point. But when the actual time came, with the burglaries and the area just falling apart, you know, and the pub was changed, is changing as well, and the society, the community is just really changing and being demolished from the outside, and the pressures even from the council wanting their money for the poll tax, which I wasn't going to pay. I think I just felt under a lot of stress. And so I went off to America to try and work there for a while. Would I do it again? Would I move to Colville Road or somewhere like it?
Yeah.
If I was single, no children, and it was in Germany or America, New York, I wouldn't do it in England. No, not again.
Would you ever, if you could have your time back again?
Yeah.
In Colville Road.
Yeah.
Would you do anything differently?
If I had my time back in Colville Road, and with hindsight, I would have thought more about using the property as a kind of not just exploiting it, but using it somehow differently. I would have used it as a launch to buy somewhere to live, you know, somewhere as a save money and buy another house somewhere else. I would have done that differently, because I didn't really think about it in those terms then. I would have done my house up better in Colville Road. I'd have done it much nicely. I'd have lived in it more. In hindsight, I didn't really live in it as such. I just existed in it. I regretted not living in it. I could have made it nice, which I didn't do. And it wouldn't have taken very much. I remember a friend of mine, a guy was staying there for a while, and he had a bit of a nervous breakdown. And he smashed the front window, and I just left it for 6 months without fixing it. I just left it, couldn't be bothered.
Was that on the ground floor?
Yeah.
So anyone could have got in?
Yeah, just put a bit of board over it, you know, and just... And one of the things I never did, I never socialised there, I never brought people there. I never brought girlfriends there, anything. Nothing.
That's so true, because you came into my house, didn't you?
Once. Probably. Well, they tried to shock you or something. What was I trying to do?
Did
I make a pass at you?
I went to pick up some stretchers.
Yeah.
And then what was really funny was you put these boxes on your head and these stretchers, and you walked down Colville Road with everything balancing on your head.
One of my party tricks.
Really elegantly.
Yeah.
And I actually, now you mention it, I thought, yeah, because I used to see you around a lot and chat to you and so forth. But you was another one of these mystery people that, like, you'd just see around, but you'd never actually seen what their house was like inside. Mm. Like, some people were kind of much more like open house, and I wasn't a sort of open house person either, but I think sort of the other person that reminds, I think of as well, similar to you, was John Smith, and that he was another person that I knew of, and but I didn't know much about him, you know what I mean? So some people you knew by name, but you didn't know too much else about them, or other people you knew a bit more because you talked to them, but you'd never seen inside their house.
No, not many people saw inside my house, apart from the people who were prepared to live there, who were desperate for someone to live. As I said, I didn't do anything to it. I did try to get rid of the dry rot in one wall, so I took the wall down. I took the plaster down and sprayed the, or coated it with some horrible chemical. I think nearly killed me, probably.
Yeah.
And I left it. I sealed it and left it. I never socialised there, really. I mean, the people I live with, the people who were sort of desperate somewhere to stay and stayed there for a while, I obviously saw them, but none of my... I remember once I brought Sophie Price back to the house, and I just didn't live there as such. I just, I think mostly when I wanted to see people, they'd come to the studio in Greenwich, and I even cooked there for people more so than I did at home. I never even cooked at home, really, in Leighton. Not really. I used to go to the cafes for breakfast. I tended to go to people's houses than then come to mine, because maybe shame. I don't know what it was, really. Because I just lived there in a very poor state, really. I just didn't do that nicely. I mean, other people lived quite normally.
Yeah.
There, and in terms of having partnerships and nice painted walls and stuff, I just never got around to it. I just left it. Left it quite neglectful, really. That's quite neglectful.
Did you put any of your paintings on the wall?
No, I didn't have any work at home. Didn't. I don't think I did anyway. I did occasionally work there. I did drawings there. No, I didn't have a car, so at the time I didn't drive.
Yeah.
I cycled everywhere, so I couldn't really carry work around, and at one point, somebody did work in the house. Stuart had a room to paint in, and I kept one room a bit like a studio in the house, or storage of stuff and drawing stuff and stuff mostly for my students, really. And
So your students came and used the house as well.
One or two of them did. Yes, I didn't really.
So they just had you let them use the room as a studio.
Yeah, sometimes.
Oh.
Yeah. I didn't work there, but as I wish.
Hi.
Hi. I will. Yes. Yeah. I kind of wish I'd made it more comfortable.
Yeah.
I wish I did, and I wish I'd use it more for living, and I had friends around, or even had a girlfriend living there or something at some point. But I just didn't. I just wasn't focused on that kind of thing. I just focused on making pictures.
Mm.
So yeah.
And you know that guy who got ill in your house and broke the window?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was to do with the pressure of the situation in Colville Road, or?
I think
or is he, that something else?
He had other pressures. I think he was at art school. He went to Liverpool, Stuart, and he needed somewhere to work, actually. He was one of the people I let work in the house when he wasn't living there. But in the time he was working there in the studio room upstairs, he left his wife and kids, his two kids and his wife, and he came to live in the house as well. And he was obviously going to under a lot of stress.
Mm.
And he just broke down really at some point. I think he had a couple of young girlfriends and then just collapsed mentally. And at one point I had to sit on him in the street till the police came to so he doesn't go and damage anybody else's property. And yeah, that was a stressful time, poor Stuart.
So he got some help and everything.
Yeah, he did really weird things. Like he'd go to the Angela Flowers and try and find my work and destroy it in the gallery.
and destroy the gallery.
Yeah, I think he was somehow focused on me and my work or success or what it was. And I suppose he just somehow projected some of his stresses onto me, really. And he just don't know, really. Just the odd time, but I did. He did actually get help, and years later he tried to get in contact with me again, just as a friend, you know, and I just thought, well, no, I don't really want to go there again. I was a bit selfish, really. I just said, well, I'm sure he was only going to apologise or something, but I just left it. Sleeping dogs.
Yeah.
Sleeping madmen. Sorry, it's a bit cruel, isn't it? Yeah. And I had some really bad adventure. I had another girl there, actually. A girl, she wasn't an artist or something. I don't know what she was. I think she did English. She's very, very good at literature. And she needed somewhere to stay. I met her at the party in Brixton. And she stayed there. And she was a schizophrenic.
Oh, no, Tony.
Yeah, she was, yeah. Well, hyper. Sort of, she's hyper and depressive as well. And one day, she was on pills, basically. She was on pills, and one day she decided to stop taking the pills. And she came home from work, or whatever she was doing. She met a sister in town somewhere, and she stripped off in a bar, in a hotel, and started playing the piano, and they escorted her out and stuff. She came home to me, her husband. She decided I was her husband. She came back to the house in Colville Road, came into my bedroom, stark naked, jumped on me and said, I want a baby now, husband. She just lost it. She wanted me to be, she came back from that day out, having stopped taking the pills, and I was her husband, and we were a partnership, we were married. She phoned the mother up, said, her husband, me, was, I don't know, talking about us as a couple. And but the ridiculous part of it was that she was actually, this was Friday night, she came back and all this stuff. I literally had to get her off me because she was in that state of hyperness and she was so strong. I had to get her off me in the bed. I was in bed, she came into my bed, started jumping on me, and as my wife. And I managed to get hold of her and put her in a room, put her to bed. The next morning, I could hear her on the phone ordering everything that was needed to renovate the house to standard. She was ordering the roof to be mended. She was ordering a car for us. She was buying these things over the phone. And at one point, she bought a car. She'd bought a car over the phone. I don't know how she did it, but she did it.
A credit card.
She bought a car for us. And the other person on the other end of the phone must have said, come and collect the car. And she said, I can't come and collect the car because I have no shoes on. It was the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. And at that point, he realised she was obviously not quite there. And, yeah. And for that weekend, I was she was Mrs. Daly, you know. And she had a breakdown and she left. She left in the end because she went to live with her parents.
Gosh.
Owing me lots of money, actually. That's the ins and outs of Colville Road, 66 Colville Road. It's 1/6 less than the devil's number. That's what I used to say to myself and my friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had two mental breakdowns there. Friends. But she was ill before, she just didn't take her pills.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So So no wonder you was pretty glad to leave.
Yeah, I was glad to leave. I was glad to leave teaching. I was glad to leave everything I was involved with at the time, really. I just wanted to just... I wanted to work in America. So I just went. I was... Found up a friend, living in at the time in Phoenix, went over there, stayed, and didn't come back for quite a couple of years, really. So yeah.
Did you show any work when you was out there?
A little bit. Not really. I lived off whatever money I had saved up. I lived off. Came back completely broke.
Mm.
2 years later. Yeah.
And. In Covell Road, can you remember anything about, the high road or any shops that, or anything that stood out that perhaps isn't there anymore?
There was a local grocer, the vegetable shop. I can't remember the name, the couple ran it. But used to be able to go there any time of the night and buy beer.
Oh.
She had a sort of secret stash of Nigerian... beer, large bottles of beer. So if I got back late from partying in wherever I was, and I could always go there and buy something to eat and get a large bottle of beer.
So was it open 24 hours?
It's, you could always knock. They're always open. They're always in, they're always in the back room. So if you were part of the in crowd, you could you know what to do to get yourself a beer or two. Any time of that, really, if they weren't asleep. And I did actually start to go to the local snooker club a bit on Friday evenings to drink with a guy I met who in the pub. He used to go with, I can't remember his name now, he used to drive trains, drive the underground. I think it's called Eddie, I'm not sure if it's called Eddie or Freddie or something like that. Ed, not sure, but... we used to go to the local local sort of dive hole, really, for beer and stuff late at night as well, and kebabs and stuff. The local boys, lads' life, as much as they could in the East End, really.
And how did you know the train driver? Was he living near you or something?
Yeah, he lived. He used to go to the pub, the Northcote. That's where I met him.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, he was Turkish, and he used to like to do the misogynist stuff. You know, talk about the women across the room, but never actually speak to them. Yeah, he talked about what he'd like to do to her when he met them and stuff, but he never actually met anybody. He never got beyond talking about them. Never actually spoke to them. And he thought I could help him to do that, so I tried. That's this funny story of the train driver.
And just before you was moving out, you mentioned the fire next door. Had any of the other houses around been boarded up or demolished or anything?
I don't think it had been demolished, actually, because I think our lot was the first. Actually, the next door had gone. The corner of Culver Road up to where we were had been knocked down. So I think they were through something for the traffic. The workmen's vans to drive through. So one house had been knocked down next to the one that was burnt.
Oh.
I think, yeah. In the corner. They made a path so they can, their storage, the workmen can store their stuff behind the houses somewhere along the line, because, train line.
Have you been down that street since?
I dream about it sometimes. I can't remember what I've actually seen. So if I talk about it now, I'd be confused to what I actually dreamt or what I've seen. Because I know I've been to the pub, and I've... because I remember actually going back there. I remember, I think about a month ago, I just dreamt that I went back to clear my house back from the people who's living there now.
How strange.
Yeah, and they'd done it up, and I remember feeling regretful that I hadn't done it up before, and I wanted to show them I could do it. So I dream about it sometimes, but I drive to Suffolk a lot for weekends now with the kids, because Nicky's dad, my partner's father, lives in Norfolk, in Suffolk, on Norfolk virtually. So we go there quite a lot, and I drive whenever I go to that part of the world, and if go east, I drive through Leighton, and I go past the street sometimes to tell my kids where I used to live. And yeah.
They locked down your house in the end, did they?
Yeah, I think it's done. Yeah, yeah.
Because I always wondered, you know, because if you go around there now, they've built these new build houses over where your house
really
was. So I was thinking, well, yeah, there was loads of houses they knocked down that they didn't have to knock down.
Yeah, I remember thinking that at some point. Yes, they did. And yeah, I remember thinking they didn't really have to knock my house down at all. They didn't. And I wonder if I should have stayed longer, but obviously I couldn't have stayed any longer because Acme asked us to leave, asked me to leave anyway. Yeah, and there's no way you can make any kind of claim on it. Because, you know, morally you could say, well, you know, you're moving for nothing, so morally you should rehouse me. But no, no. I mean, c'est la vie, really. Good luck to whoever's living there now, if they like it. Yeah.
So when you moved out, do you remember any of the other artists who moved out?
Well, Julian Perry, he went and bought a flat with his partner, Sally. My friend Steph, the banker next door, he moved to Crystal Palace, or he moved to southeast London, where I'm living now. Jack bought, my friend Jack Jeffrey, she bought a flat in Hackney. Now she's finally moved up to Forest Hill as well, where I'm living. Who else?
So, kind of in a way, all those people around that little block.
Yeah.
Plus some other artists moved out in one go.
Yeah, I think, generally speaking, everyone went at the same time to various direction. I went to America, of course. I went straight to America. So,
do you know if anyone squatted your house, or did you take your keys back to Acme?
Acme was quite on the ball. They took the money. Compensation to cover what some of the rent I owed them. I gave them the keys. I think it was boarded up quite quickly, or metalled or grilled over.
Did you have to wait for Acme to come to you at the house?
I think so. Yeah, they came to the door. Yeah, because I remember what I did. What I did, I packed two suitcases, and everything else I had was put in the street from the house.
You just left.
I gave all my art books to friends to keep, and I put all my whatever I had in the street to be taken by people for free, and I packed two suitcases to take with me to America, and that was it. That's all I took with me, and that's all. And I gave the keys to whoever it was from Acme, and I just didn't look back until many years later when I met up with my friend Steph, who used to live next door. And it's his wild student days, so we tend to we go over to Leighton for a drink every so often. We might even go soon.
Has the pub changed a lot?
Yes, it has changed. Yeah, it's not, you know, it's not those sort of it's changed a bit. Yeah, yeah, not as nice as it used to be.
In what way?
Well, it used to be kind of a really traditional pub. Now it's not. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what it is now, because last time I went must have been about 2 years ago now.
But the pub hasn't changed.
Not really.
You're talking about the people.
The people, yeah. The artist gang is not there anymore. You know, the local kind of artist group we sang about, the people, the painters, artist. Pete, whatever his name is. Do you remember Pete?
Pete Owen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see, you know, he's not there anymore. Yeah, all those people. Yeah. Different community now, really, living there. Yeah.
Pete doesn't live too far from there now.
No.
He lives in Mallus Road.
Oh, really?
Which is sort of behind the station between Leighton and Leightonstone. But some people did sort of end up staying, didn't they?
Yeah, he organised himself quite well. I mean, I reckon he must have bought a house somewhere, and he would have bought a house somewhere and lived there, knowing him. It's all quite organised.
Mm-hmm.
He had quite a good teaching job, didn't he, or something?
Yeah, at the time. The side.
Yeah. Yeah, got lucky. Some people got lucky. Bought houses nearby. Yeah.
Don't you think you got lucky, though? Because in a way, like, you had such a great time in the fact that you was doing all that work and having Angela Flowers and just sort of producing, really.
Yeah, I suppose in that sense, yeah, I was one of the people who actually did, in terms of, at the time, just working and showing, yeah. And it served its purpose, and I felt, you know, I felt really privileged and very lucky compared to most people there, in that sense. But I mean, like Connie Parker now, she's really flying, isn't she? Yeah. She was one of my friends around there at the time. I don't think she ever went to my house. I went to her house a few times.
What yeah. was that like?
Connie's house was just, she just made it livable, nice and livable. She had a studio there. Her work was all over the place. I remember seeing all her lead pieces hanging up in the house and stuff, and around the walls and around the house. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was really nice, you know, organised, mature living, really. Yeah. Unlike me. I was always in transit to somewhere, mentally.
And all the people's houses that you went round, you know, like, what was Julian Perry's house like, for example?
Julian was he was living with his partner. They had a night. They did the house quite nicely. They moved. Then they bought a flat in Leighton, which they did up quite nicely. Yeah, and it's still there. I think they're selling it now, actually, trying to move on. But they're still there together. In their little house in Morley Road, little flat. You know, anything else adventurous? I mean, big adventures in Leighton. I wish I could remember any. It's really funny. I mean, one of the funniest things was having sort of my friends with the Rolls Royce coming to pick me up every so often.
Really?
Yeah, it was like a bit of a laugh. It was just, curiosity.
What was that about then?
I was at college with a lady who, Helen Keats, mad as a hatter, really exciting, and married to a very wealthy accountant come music, sort of worked in the music world, and used to live over in Barnes. And I think he probably took pleasure in driving over to pick me up every so often, to take me out and in his Rolls Royce, a chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce, I'd be coming out of the house. And he used to buy my work as well, so, you know, it's quite interesting at the time. So that's, but, you know, I think...
Did he ever go in your house?
No. No, he's just waiting there. He used to wait outside with his chauffeur, and I have to jump in. Yeah. He even organised a party for me once, a birthday party at Angela Flowers' gallery. He organised the whole thing. So I had it there.
Do you think that those people might have thought you were quite an interesting eccentric?
I guess lots of people probably thought that from different viewpoints. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah.
And I wonder if they wondered what your house was like.
I'm sure I told them. You know, I'm sure I told stories about how it was like inside, and but it was my reality. You know, I accepted it, and I was busy making pictures in my mind. You know, making art and trying to establish myself, and I wasn't particularly worried about how I lived in that time. I wish I was at the time, looking back, as I said before, I think, but yeah.
But maybe the fact that you wasn't. You know, like you wasn't in a way the typical Acme artist in the sense that, you know, because the thing with Acme is like you do up your house and you have your live work studio there.
Yeah.
And you kind of almost did the opposite by leaving it as it was, but also taking the plaster off and never quite finishing it. You know, that was just another way of enabling you to focus on what was important, which at the time was, you know, producing your work.
I was really incredibly focused on that, really, and nothing else got in the way, really. And I wish I'd worked a bit less at the time so I could actually see the work a bit better at the time, because I think lots of work I made was this experimental crappy stuff, you know. Looking back at it now, but I've seen some of the work today actually made there, and it's not too bad. when I was living there.
So, like, maybe that was, like, what you thought at the time. So if you had a lot of that work now and you looked at it now, you might think, actually, it was pretty refined.
Yeah, some of the successful stuff was, yeah, quite exciting. I liked it at the time, but, you know, as I said, a lot of it was, you know, it was just, I don't know, really, too, a little bit ugly. But it's okay, yeah, it's a good time. You know, my partner now, she was living in America when I was living in, and she used to come over and see me as a friend in Leighton. And I think she got an overall view that I somehow were all depressed and poor and stuff, because she's quite wealthy in America.
Oh.
And she got the view, because I was always striving for something, I think she got the view that I was somehow... I mean, she's one of the few people who actually stayed in my house and slept in like, with me there.
Yeah.
When she came over from America. She didn't need to, but she'd come and see me. And she formed a view about it. And I think, you know, she's not used to that kind of roughness, you know, which I was prepared to live with. That kind of deprivation, which I'm prepared to live with. And she was worried about it. Worried about me, actually. And now we're living together. We've lived together for like 13 years now. And I think it was about 6 months ago, I actually said to her, you know, why are you so concerned about how I used to live then? Because, you know, it's a really rich artistic community, which I really enjoyed living in. And I realised I never actually said it to her before. And so she'd formed this view that I was really somehow on the constant distress while I was living in Colville Road. I wasn't. I was, you know, obviously under a lot of some distress in terms of still struggling to work, you know, that kind of stress, but nothing more than that. I was, you know, I was prepared to live in the house as it was. I didn't need to bring anybody there. My parents never visited it. You know, one of my sisters came to see me to spend a weekend once or twice. And they probably formed their own view as well. But, you know, I was rebel. I was a rebel artist, you know. I was trying to work it, you know, work the system so I can keep painting.
And I think actually that period of time, because there was still that kind of squatty culture about before they sort of changed the law on squatting.
Yeah.
A lot of people actually lived in that sort of way, actually. I mean, I did before I got my Acme house when I was squatting down Brick Lane.
Yeah.
Living in a virtually derelict place that I was slowly doing up, but it was pretty rough, actually, compared to Colville Road. And I think maybe, sort of, if you're an outsider coming in to that, you would feel quite concerned and you would perhaps form a stereotypical opinion.
Yeah.
But and I do think there was a kind of artistic poverty.
Yeah.
But there was also a lot of pleasure in that, I think. Because people were doing their work, they were doing what they wanted to do.
That's that bohemian mentality, isn't it? Yeah, I guess there was. I mean, when I left art school, I was living in Battersea when I was at Chelsea, and I went towards that bohemian thinking process. I went to find a squat. I walked down the Cold Harbour Lane and I saw three people across the road who were obviously looking for squats as well. So I crossed over, we met and we became like a foursome. We found a squat in Camberwell. We squatted there for a while until we developed it. And then I didn't develop mine too much because I left it quite bare. But the other flat's quite well developed in the mansion block we lived in. And so when it came to moving to Colville Road, it's quite easy for me. It's slightly better than where I was living before.
Yeah.
But actually, people who stayed in the house in the squat, they're all owning it now. They're all doing really well financially out of it. You know, they bought it for like £5,000 and they're worth £300,000 now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if I'd stayed, I'd be a lot wealthier than I am now. But that wasn't my focus, really. Just my focus was to make those bloody paintings. The bohemian lifestyle, the sort of financial deprivation, the the environmental deprivation, like at home, was to me part of how I kind of imagine a working class painter would function. If you leave college, your parents don't give you a lot of money to go and buy a house, and you either squat or find association housing, which where everyone else did, or until acne came along, and that's what I did as well.
So are you from a working class background as well?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, from up in Leeds, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, went to art school. First person from my family to probably got an A-level in the history of time.
Yeah.
Because
I think, you know, we were that generation in a way. It was like the Wilson government in the 70s gave opportunities.
Gave us promises.
Working class kids to go to university.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, you know, that's certainly all stopped, really.
Yeah, I said stop, but I still try to do it, don't I? But it's not. It's more so now, I'm sure. But you can't. You're not allowed to go and do things stupid like art schools, things you can't make money out of. If you're working class, you have to go and find a vocational training or vocational degree. I think that's the push these days. But
because people can't afford the fees.
Yeah. But I left art. I left school, you know, comprehensive up in Leeds, and I went to art school. Not even know what an art school was before I went. You know, the day before I went, didn't even know they existed. I think that's what I tell myself. That's what I tell myself anyway. but there was it was an extraordinary optimism. You know, and I think. It's all part of that. I mean, and you're bought into the bohemian lifestyle, not by choice. Because I mean, one of the guys who I bumped into on the street when I was looking for my squat, he turned out to be a multimillionaire. He had millions in the bank at the time.
Oh my goodness.
His dad owned 1/3 of Guernsey or something at the time.
So why was he squatting? Do you know?
Because he was trying to. He was bohemian because by choice.
Oh.
William was bohemian by choice. When the pressures got heavy in, because we were living in that house in Campbell, the flat in Campbell, the squatter's flat, the local community of young children in the area and got really quite curious about us, because we sort of been to art school or college or whatever, and they didn't quite understand, and they became quite. Their curiosity got the better of them, really, and they started. I mean, I got shot at with an air rifle for curiosity, you know. They used to break into the houses to see where we lived. I don't know why, but they just—it's really curious. And plus, one of the flats in the squat got squatted by some Scottish drug addicts, you know, and they just brought the place down with drugs and violence and theft, and when that happened. I moved to Leighton, and William went and bought a house in Brixton, cash.
Oh, God.
Honestly. Yeah. So, just went and bought a house in Brixton. He had £1 million in the bank, £2 million in the bank his dad had given him. Which, you know, and I met him down the road again for a squat, looking for a squat. So he'd chosen the bohemian lifestyle by choice, and I had no choice, really. I mean, either that or I could get a job. And I wasn't prepared to go and get a job, full-time job and not paint, so no choice about that really, but just go and live cheaply.
I was quite interested about what you said, that when you left art school you had this idea that you would spend time, you know, you'd get a part-time job and then spend a longer time on your paintings and then later get success, and then the kind of, in a way, what happened was you got all that success all at once.
Yeah, instantly, really. Even before I left art school, I was showing Angela Flowers. Who knows? I mean, I left art school with that kind of optimism in terms of the work. Making my optimism was about being an artist and making good paintings. At the back of my mind, I didn't see how a working class black kid was going to. Sell work, who to? I couldn't imagine who was going to sell work to. And I remember also my tutor at college was Christopher Lebrun, And he left art school and worked for 10 years, you know, quietly and calmly. He had the money, though. But he worked calmly and then, and then suddenly this, his work just took off. And I thought it was quite a good model, really. And I thought, well, I'd leave college and I would focus on getting a part-time job, teaching job if possible, and live as cheap as possible, work as hard as I possibly could, develop the work slowly without prying eyes of galleries and stuff, and take it to a level where I thought it would be worth showing. But unfortunately, or very fortunately, I got Angela Flowers on, you know, on my, in my camp straight away, on my side, and they were supportive and did a lot of work for me, and I was showing work all the time. And I was quite resentful of that at the time, really, because I thought they were messing with my plans, you know? Yeah. So that's quite, I was a little bit resentful of that, because I didn't feel I was getting the freedom to do what I, you know, to really let the work be crappy, as bad as it needed to be. And to meet people, different people, you know, and to take part in competitions and stuff, which, you know, I didn't really have to do. You know, I didn't have to enter the John Moores to get shows and stuff, which other people had to do and stuff. So,
Do you think that maybe something to do with being working class had something to do with maybe your, in a way, sort of view of, you know, you said you felt like out of control, or you were being, your work was being controlled in a way and you couldn't have that stretch of time. Do you think, because that maybe you wanted, I don't know, maybe it was this work ethic, because, you know, you worked very hard, but maybe it's almost that thing of like wanted to work, you know, quite hard, but then at certain points achieving certain things gradually over time, which kind of gives you something to work for. And do you think maybe that was something to do with your thinking? I don't know.
My initial thinking was, at the time, I remember thinking, who the fuck is going to buy my work, you know? Who's going to want what I did, you know, when I was at art school? I did win several prizes and stuff, but you know, I didn't have, you know, my parents on their wall only had one of those typical prints on canvas like thing of Jesus on the wall, you know, that's the only art we had in my house. And I honestly didn't know who bought art or why. I didn't, you know, I wouldn't have bought art at the time, and I didn't want it, specifically to buy it. To the point where I didn't even have my own work at home, you know, is work, somehow. I didn't have a very nice relationship with it. It's all about struggle, you know, it's all about struggle and pain and struggle and sacrifice. I didn't really have a happy time with work at the time. And I couldn't visualize who was going to come and buy the work. And all I could visualize was getting better and being good at it. And I thought if you got good enough and got a level of, you know, competence, then you might start to force your way into some, you know, force your way into the museums and stuff. That was my thought pattern at the time. And I set out to work towards that goal, really. But by chance, Angela Flowers came and got me early.
And so people were buying your work.
Yeah, and I just, it all baffled me.
Despite what you thought about it.
Yeah, despite what I thought of it, they were buying it. And I just, you know, I thought, well, if they're daft enough, then they're welcome to it. I wasn't going to have it in my home. I'm joking. So
it's interesting, that kind of self criticism, in that level of self criticism, when you're actually in this so-called like really successful place.
But then again, you start, you know, there were people. I wasn't Angela Flowers, the most successful artist, you know, within that circle of that group of people. I wasn't. I was probably the cheapest in the gallery.
Right.
I think I was probably the cheapest, if not one of the cheapest, you know, and I wasn't the worst.
Yeah.
And so that kind of got certain mental dynamics working as opposed to where I was going to end up, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years' time. And is it worth hanging in there with that kind of being, you know, and seeing if it kicks off another level at some point? I wanted to get to another level with the work.
Right.
And, you know, and I think I felt I needed space for that. And I needed also to be in a nice studio to work as well. And probably also, at some point, I would need to live somewhere nice as well.
And do you think you've got to that level now, in a way?
Now, I've got an okay home to a point. Got my two beautiful children. My fucked up relationship at home, but that's another matter. That's really fucked, but I'm not the only one who's fucked up. Yeah, that relationship is probably fucked, I don't know. the urge to work really hard again is really coming back.
Oh, that's good.
And I'm scared for my children.
You're scared?
Yeah, I'm frightened for them.
Why? Because you think that you'll neglect them?
Yeah. I'm really scared I might, you know, neglect them or, make them suffer for it. They're at school full time now, so it's, you know, and I teach a bit now as well.
Where do you teach?
At the moment, I'm at the Blackheath Conservatoire, which I really enjoy.
Yeah.
It's dodgy there in terms of, it's a private college and the classes are group number dependent. Mm-hmm. And because it's a private college, it's got lots of very, very posh people.
Mm.
And I'm not sure. They see me as their ideal teacher. So some of them put me on a lot of stress for that reason, I think. Because they have this ideal of, you know, the artist being a certain way.
Yeah.
Teaching a certain way. I can go in there and pretend to be a watercolourist, and, you know. But I don't pretend. I'm really quite honest with them. And I tell them what I'm about. And I don't put airs and graces on. I don't put any distance between us at all. We're all adults and I work like that. And they're not expecting that, so they're a bit worried about me. But I like them all, most of them. And I'm really enjoying teaching there.
Mm.
It's not, you know, it's only part-time. And I'm not back at Chelsea, I'm not back at the Slade.
Mm.
That seemed to have disappeared now with them, you know.
Do you think you could approach Chelsea and the Slade again?
The only way I'd approach Chelsea or the Slade for a teaching job is if I had a show in the Metropolitan Museum. Or somewhere, the Tate, you know, Tate Modern or something, which isn't going to happen for a while. It'd be real. If it did, I would. If somebody came to me now and offered me a show at the Tate, I would take it, but I'd be very suspicious something's really going on.
So, basically, you'd be like those artists down Colville Road whose doors you knocked on, saying that you have this buyer.
Yeah.
This gallerist who wanted to come and see their work, and they were really suspicious and didn't believe you.
Yeah, well, it's true, yeah. That's how I would be now, because I think it's a matter of confidence, isn't it? Or something, I don't know what it is, but yeah. I wouldn't... now I don't enter the role... Now I don't enter John Moore's because I don't think the work is good enough, strong enough. Not because I'm too busy with Angela Flowers. No, it's just, you know... I visualise it being somewhere, and it's not quite where what I visualise. The work might be good, but, you know, I don't know. I can't see it. So, I work a lot less than I used to, which worries me. My comfort zone is... I'm not really into my comfort zone, because I only work, say, if I come in at 9 or 10 and work till 3. I have to pick the kids up from school. I do all that still. Drop them off and pick them up most days. And, I don't work in the evenings like I used to anymore. So I have a much shorter day. And for me, I don't have that freedom, that sense of... I'm not in flow where I used to be in Leighton. I used to be really in flow in Leighton. When I lived in Leighton, I was really flying as an artist in my mind. I was working one picture to the next. Everywhere I was working mentally.
Mm.
And I had no distractions, really. And now I have my happy distractions. And I'm committed to them. And committed to them. And I'm working as much, probably as much as any other artist. Any of the artists here, for example.
Yeah.
But for me, it's just not quite enough. It's really frustrating. And it doesn't make me very happy. So my doctor wants to prescribe pills. I'm joking, but they have suggested it. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm an artist. I'm not depressed. But yeah, okay. Yeah, and I work smaller now. My studio's obviously smaller, and I make smaller pictures mostly. And always worrying about money, and I don't like to spend too much money on the work because I want to spend it on the children. And
I noticed that painting behind. It's got 1992 on, so you've managed to keep some of your pieces from that time.
Yeah, as I said earlier, I was just making new storage space, and I try and keep two or three pictures from each era of work for myself to look at every so often. And that's from the Colville time when I was really flying. And I've just seen it for the first time in about maybe 6 years, 7 years today.
Great.
Yeah, and it's really fresh and it's really alive, and it's how I wanted to paint then, and it's how, you know, and it's fine.
So at the time, did you actually see that in that piece of work?
No.
So it's something to do with being having a distance.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, because people say to me now the work I'm doing now is okay, and I'm maybe just too close to it, but I wouldn't throw it into the John Moores next year or something, or whatever, which is, I wouldn't do that with anything I've got now. Just, it's maybe just a personality thing. It's the way I function. I just don't, I think I'm always struggling for the piece beyond out of view.
Yeah.
And the one in view is so, you know, it's never quite good enough.
Mm.
Maybe. The one around the corner. Yeah.